Hello, Shalom. My name is Nachum Amzel, and this podcast is What Does Judaism Say About? This is the full podcast. Today's topic is the Jewish view of individuality and conformity. The right and prerogative to be an individualist is cherished in a free democratic society, especially in the United States, whose very foundation rests upon the concept of individuality. This is true whether describing dress, thoughts, or actions. And yet at the same time, everyone also has another inner drive to conform, to be like everyone else, and be accepted as part of a group. Actually, if we think about it, people tend to dress like others want them to dress. That is what fashion is all about. That is what advertising is all about. In reality, most people have a psychological desire to think and act as part of a group. This psychological component has affected people 100 times more today in the age of social media. Both of these competing drives within each person are played out differently within each society and within the thoughts and behaviors of each individual. Both of these tendencies and the tensions they cause can be found within Judaism as well. Numerous sources in the Talmud, Medrash, and the commentaries highlight the importance of individuality in Judaism. However, the Torah also seems to stress conformity to Jewish law as paramount in importance. How these two ideas interact in Jewish thought will be central to the theme of this podcast. The Talmud records a story that occurred right after the death of Reish Lakish, the close friend and study partner of Rabbi Yochanan, whose arguments with Reish Lakish are recorded on hundreds of pages in the Talmud. Rabbi Yochanan was naturally saddened and depressed about the loss of his colleague, who was also his brother-in-law. So the other rabbis decided to send him over some of their best and brightest young scholars to learn with him. They heard a shiur, a class in Judaism from Rabbi Yochanan, and at its conclusion, they stood and applauded Rabbi Yochanan's erudition and genius by citing support for his arguments from other sources. Instead of being happy upon receiving these compliments, Rabbi Yochanan suddenly became angry and cried out for the son of Lakisha, Reish Lakish, desirous of the heated arguments that they had waged on a daily basis in the past. Rabbi Yochanan claimed that Reish Lakish would shoot down Rabbi Yochanan's ideas with 24 objections, which he would then answer in return. It is clear that Rabbi Yochanan was not satisfied with the scholars because they agreed with him, i.e. they conformed. But Rabbi Yochanan desired instead the arguments of the individual reasoning of Reish Lakish, who disagreed with him all the time. This story supports the importance of individuality in Jewish learning and thought. This incident, however, may just be a story and not the normative view of Judaism. Are there any other statements to support this view of individuality in Jewish learning? The Talmud states that each scholar is called upon as an individual with different ideas than other scholars to sharpen the mind of his fellow scholars through disagreements and debates. In the classic Jewish classroom, the lowliest student is encouraged to challenge the Rebbe teacher in a respectful manner, of course, by asking questions and disagreeing with the Rebbe teacher's interpretation of any particular passage. Each page of the Talmud is filled with arguments between rabbis who differed in their thoughts and ideas with others. The Mishnah states that the bashful student cannot possibly learn. Thus, an individual thought and opinion is certainly encouraged in Judaism and even needed in order to produce proper Jewish learning. While the decisors of the Talmud, the editors, could merely have recorded the final Jewish practice, the final decisions and opinions of only those rabbis that are now followed regarding each Jewish law, they purposely edited the Talmud to include all of the contrary opinions of the rabbis who are not followed in practice. In a similar manner, knowing full well that the law is generally decided by the majority of Mishnaic opinions, the formulators of the Mishnah, the first part of the Talmud, also included those individual opinions of the Tanaim, the rabbis of the Mishnah, who are not followed in Jewish law. One of the major reasons for this is to emphasize the importance of independent thought in Judaism that is not necessarily practiced. The importance and acceptability of individuality in Judaism can also be seen from a Talmudic statement that speaks about the people of Israel and says that just as each face of each Jew is very different from all other Jews, so too every Jew's opinion is different from each and every other Jew. Even the leaders of the Jewish people were individualistic in style. Though God appeared to all the 48 prophets with essentially the same message for the people, to become better Jews, to become better people, it says that each prophet prophesied in his or her own unique style. Long before there was a Jewish people, the importance of individuality was stressed in the Torah, according to the Sephorno commentary. In the story of the Tower of Babel, the Torah twice mentions in one verse the oneness of these people. Most commentaries explain this as a positive characteristic, unity, as possibly the one redeeming value that prevented that generation from being destroyed, like the generation of Noah before it. Sephorno, however, explains the Torah's use of these phrases as highlighting their sin. Their very oneness, says Sephorno, shows that they were part of a dictatorship society where they were unable to explore ideas as individuals. This was the sin of that society, the prevention of individual thinking. Without individual thought, they could not possibly come to properly understand the notion of God. It was a fitting punishment, then, that there was a separation of that one people, that one group, where there was unanimity. They separated into many languages and many cultures. And God is telling the people of the world that they must view life as individuals and not immediately conform to the ideas and practices of others. Other midrashic sources show that individuality is at the very essence of being a Jew. There are three classical names in the scripture for the person who today is called a Jew: Hebrew, Israelite, and Jew. The very first Jew, Abraham, was called a Hebrew in the Torah because, according to the Midrash, the term signifies that regarding belief and action, the entire world was on one side, while Abraham was on the other side, Aver, Ivri, Hebrew. Abraham's actions and belief separated him from all others in his generation. The name Israel was given to Jacob after he fought with the angel of God. Through this name change, he was thus transformed from Jacob, which means following on the heels of someone else, to Israel, which signifies wrestled with God. This transformation may be understood not only as a change within Jacob himself, but a change for his descendants as well, from followers, conformists, into leaders and individualists. Finally, the most common name used today, Jew, was first used in its present context with reference to Mordechai in the Purim story. Until that time, the term Jew, Yehudi, was a description of a person who belonged to the tribe of Judah. When the Megillah described Mordechai, who the verse says was from the tribe of Benjamin, but also as a Yehudi, the Medrash naturally asks, what's the meaning of this term? Among the answers given, Mordechai was thus described because he was an individualist, refusing, like everyone else, to follow the norms of the Persians and bow down to Haman. The term Yehudi, says the Medrash, comes from the Hebrew word Yechidi, an individualist. Therefore, it can be seen that all three biblical names for the term Jew describe in some fashion the characteristic of individuality. Within the sources pointing to the importance of individuality in Judaism that we cited, the Torah itself seems to take an opposite viewpoint. In outlining the importance of adhering to Jewish law, the Torah states that the concept of one statute for all, or one law and one ordinance. The Jewish people are thus admonished to conform. The Torah's logic in taking this view is easy to understand. It cannot be left to the individual Jew to decide, for example, on which day of the week should I keep Shabbat, just as the individual rituals of that Shabbat, or any other Jewish holiday or ritual, cannot be arbitrarily decided by each Jewish man or Jewish woman. Failure of Jews as a people to conform to basic principles and actions would inhibit or obstruct any sense of Jewish community or unified Judaism. The Torah's stress on conformity, however, seems to go far beyond the basic logic necessary to keep together an organized society, religion, or community. Unlike other societies of today, or certainly throughout history, the Torah does not allow anyone, even the leaders of the community, to deviate from adherence to the laws given to all the people. In addition to the general commandment for every Jew to write his or her personal Torah, the Torah commands the Jewish king to write his own Torah in addition to that required of every other Jew. In an unusual departure from the norm, the Torah text explains itself why the king must write this extra Torah. It says that the king should read it always in order to ensure that he will keep all of its laws, despite his natural desire to think of himself as above the law. This unusual commandment, elaborated upon by the commentaries, runs contrary to the laws of government in our century or in any century, even in democratic Western countries. While history has amply demonstrated that kings and rulers of nations have always lived by their own set of rules, then different than the people they govern, presidents and heads of democratic governments today still retain special status when it comes to adherence of the laws of the land. President Trump has fought for his right to ignore these laws as president, since the laws of everyone else do not apply to the President of the United States. In the USA, the concept of executive privilege does indeed, according to law, allow all presidents to ignore some of the laws or bypass other statutes, but not all. His ability to pardon any criminal and declare emergency powers when he sees the need as commander-in-chief runs contrary to democratic principles and attests to his special status before the law. In the state of Israel, as in many other countries, members of the Knesset parliament do have immunity from prosecution for breaking state laws, and diplomatic immunity for all foreign diplomats gives them the right to commit crimes without retribution. These concepts are accepted virtually all over the world. And yet, contrary to this norm, the Torah stresses that no one, not even the king or president of the country, can be above the law. All must conform. Some scholars have even pointed to this particular concept as the origin of true democracy, and not in Athens, Greece, because it was the first time in history where a leader of a country was subjugated to the very same basic laws as all its citizens. How then can the apparent contradiction between these two fundamental concepts be resolved? How can the Torah's apparent stress upon conformity remain congruent within the sources stressing Jewish individuality? Is it possible for the Jew to conform and yet remain an individualist? One possible solution lay in distinguishing between Jewish action and Jewish thought. While traditional Jews did and needed to conform to basic Jewish practice, individual opinion was never stifled. Shulchan Aruch codified Jewish practice for all Jews, both Ashkenazic and Sephardic, but the Talmud and its varied opinions continues to be studied and debated from generations and generations in the past and even today. This distinction between Jewish thought and Jewish action can readily be seen in the procedures of the Sanhedrin, the body of rabbis who decided in temple times new questions that arose in Jewish law regarding the Jewish people. But this dichotomy between conformity of action versus individuality of thought is even alluded to in the Torah itself. When the Jewish people originally accepted the Torah and said, "We will do it, na'aseh," the Torah on two separate occasions tells us in Exodus that this acceptance of practicing the Torah was said by all Jews in unison as a totally unified people. But a few verses later, when the acceptance by the Jewish people of the Torah in practice and its ideas is recorded, na'aseh v'nishma, we will do it and we will understand it, there the unity, the words yachdav, unified, and kol echad, one voice, that were there in the first two acceptances, are conspicuously missing. From the very beginning, as Rabbi Jonathan Sachs points out, Jews understood that there could not be unanimity when it comes to Jewish thought. There is no one right idea or monolithic value concerning Jewish beliefs and outlook on life. Nor should there be. Thus, referring to the joy gained from understanding of Jewish law, Jewish ideas, and Torah life, King Solomon wrote that the paths of Torah are pleasant, not the one singular path, Darkeha Darkei Noam, but paths in plural, Darakeha Darkei Noam, because there are many ways of understanding the Torah and Judaism, properly and legitimately. The 71 Sanhedrin members debated at length any particular law in question, as mentioned above. In that debate, individuality of thought was not only tolerated, but was encouraged as part of the procedure. The Mishnah states that the Sanhedrin was organized in a semicircle, as is the Israeli Knesset parliament today. And any debate involving life and death, all the opinions had to start from the side. This meant that the youngest and most inexperienced Sanhedrin members would have to express their opinions first, since they sat at the side. This was mandated by Jewish law, so that the more respected elders could not stifle individual and differing opinions by speaking earlier in the debate and causing the younger members to be intimidated and possibly refrain from disagreeing. Thus, individuality of thought was certainly encouraged. However, once the Sanhedrin voted and the law was decided by a majority of its members, that law was adopted and applied equally to all of Israel and all the Sanhedrin members. Everyone had to conform. If a member of the Sanhedrin did not conform after the law was decided, but rather insisted on putting his original opinion into practice, he was known as a Zaken Mamre, a rebellious elder, and would be put to death. Therefore, while individual thought was tolerated and certainly encouraged, conformity of action was also demanded. Within this framework, it can be shown that traditional Judaism tolerates a total questioning of God himself. You can question mitzvot, commandments, and all aspects of Jewish religion, as long as the person continues to conform and perform the commandments while questioning. This unique religious concept, i.e., the primacy of the Jews' right to think and question, as long as conformity to general practice continues, can be seen in a unique passage which says God prefers that Jews totally abandon him, the Almighty, as long as they do not abandon observance of the Torah. The implication is that Jewish belief and Jewish thought is secondary to Jewish practice, and that what one thinks and questions is tolerated as long as practice continues. Of course, the ideal is that both Jewish thought and action should coincide. There is another approach that accommodates both of these forces of conformity and individuality within traditional Judaism. The individual Jew does conform to Jewish practice, but at the same time, he or she can retain his or her own individuality within that conformity. As long as Jews conform to the minimum standard of performance or action, there is ample room for variety and individuality within compliance to those standards. A few obvious examples will demonstrate this concept. While traditional Jews pray three times a day, the same basic prayer and words, the Amidah, the silent prayer, or Shmona Esrei, conforming to the same text in each and every service, this text serves as a minimum of prayer. There is room for the individual prayer within the Amidah itself, both in style, language, and wording. Within each individual blessings of the Amidah, such as the blessing for the sick, for example, one may add a personal, applicable thought about someone else who is ill, even with his or her name. In the 17th of the 19 blessings, a general blessing known as Shema Kolenu, each person is encouraged to add personal prayer about any subject, in any language. Thus, within the conformity, there is ample room for individuality. Another example pertains to anyone who enters a traditional synagogue on the first morning of the Sukkot holiday and will see many Jews with the four species, four specific plants that are required by the Torah to shake and hold together as part of the service. While Jewish law is very specific in defining what is an acceptable lulav, etrog, hadas, and arava, beyond this minimum standard to which everyone must conform, one can readily see that the four species in many shapes and sizes and colors in the synagogue, all conforming to that basic Jewish law. But each person picks out a unique set which suits him or her. And he or she thinks that is particularly beautiful as defined by tradition. This is also true of the sukkah itself. There are very specific standards of conformity in defining a kosher sukkah, in the manner it is constructed, and what may be used for this and for that, especially regarding its covering, the sechach. The Talmud in Tractate Sukkah spends many pages discussing these intricacies of Jewish law. Yet beyond this conformity, a Jewish family is free to construct and decorate a sukkah that suits their individual preferences on the walls, for example, which can be made of and decorated with almost any material. Thus, even though thousands and thousands of people conform to building a sukkah, as you walk into each sukkah, you can see the individuality of that family. This same concept, individuality within the framework of conformity, can be found in almost all areas of Jewish observance. The Shabbat challah bread comes in all shapes and sizes while conforming to a basic standard, as does the Shabbat wine cup and even the wine itself. Each house decides what kind of challah, what type of wine, all 100% kosher. Many aspects of the Pesach Seder on Passover give each family the opportunity to create a unique experience for that family, all within the standards of a traditional Seder that has been observed for thousands of years. The slight variations of customs and practices in each country, all within traditional Jewish framework, show that individuality need not be sacrificed for Jewish conformity. The Hanukkah menorah candelabra, the Purim groger, that noisemaker, and even the Havdalah candle weekly used at the conclusion of the Sabbath are but more examples demonstrating this concept, where individuality can be seen in each of these rituals while conformity to basic standards is maintained. Perhaps this duality, individuality within conformity in Judaism, can help best understand the Mishnah that asks why the Almighty created only one human being in creation and not a group of people, like he did with the animals and plants, where in each species more than one was created. Among the answers cited in the Mishnah, it states that unlike man's attempt to mint coins, in which each and every coin of necessity is an exact duplicate of the original mold, God's mold for humanity, the first man, is different. While every subsequent human being has many characteristics like the original, yet at the same time, each person retains individual characteristics as well that make him or her a unique creature, different from that first mold. Thus, while each normal human being has two ears, two eyes, two hands, 10 fingers, like that first man, each person also possesses individual fingerprints, individual eye print, a voice print, and other characteristics unlike anyone else's in the universe, and a unique brainwave pattern. Beyond these physical traits, the Mishnah may be indicating the dual nature of man, not only in the physical sense, in that he or she must conform to certain aspects like all of the human beings who are normal, but in other aspects, he or she retains his individuality and his uniqueness. Thank you for listening and giving of your time. If you'd like to respond or react to any of the points discussed, feel free to write on the group Facebook page, What Does Judaism Say About?, or more privately by email at What Does Judaism Say About? One word, What Does Judaism Say About? @gmail.com. In addition, if you'd like to receive a full transcript of this podcast, feel free to email as well. Please subscribe to the weekly podcast so that you will not miss even one topic. Shalom.